So I think we really do need to, before we do anything else, is really try to picture Milarepa. Milarepa, I want to picture him a bit later on in his life. When I was last here, I started the talk by reading a song of Milarepa to his guru Marpa. When Milarepa was first in solitary retreat, Lama Marpa had this extraordinarily tough, land-owning, quite corpulent, difficult guru who Milarepa had absorbed the Dharma from, had said, "I want you to spend your life meditating in the mountain fastnesses, in the caves, and just get on with that. In time, the disciples will come." Well, this time I want to go forward a bit. Milarepa did become a great teacher. In time, he gathered around him disciples, yogis like him, and also a lot of supporters, people who, they weren't going to live the yogi life, but they regarded Milarepa as their teacher. They'd go to him for teachings, and of course they would support him and his disciples with basic food stuffs and so on and so forth, even though they didn't want that life. They loved the fact that in their midst or nearby up in the mountains, usually above the snow line, there were yogis, there were hermits, there were meditators living that life. I think that's something worth reflecting on, that Tibet was, perhaps still is to a very small degree now, a culture in which the hermit, the yogi, is regarded as indispensable for a proper society, a proper world. It's just good to know that there are people getting on with that life, serving that full time, that really full time life devoted to meditation, contemplation, that direct encounter with the divine, that life of, if you like, radical, revolutionary transformation. There is something wonderful about that, and well, it's good to know in our own order that there are members of our order who spend a lot of time meditating, if not up in the caves, in the equivalent of those places. So I want you to picture Milarepa. He's probably by this time maybe in his 70s. He's very lean. He's probably got a green tinge to his skin because he lived on nettle soup for much of his life. You have to picture a really thin man, you know, quite dark because of, you know, living out in the open a lot of the time. Dreadlocks, really long, matted hair, probably wound around his head. That's one of the signs of the yogi. You just let your hair go like that. Maybe, like a lot of Tibetans, probably a soft, wispy moustache and beard. Very, though old, though lean, probably very, very handsome, very impressive. And just wearing a white cotton robe. A lower robe and an upper robe. Just white cotton, edged with red, the insignia of the yogi, the Repa. Repa means the cotton clad. Probably a meditation belt around his shoulder that he would use when he's for long periods of meditation, so he doesn't fall over when he goes into sleep meditation, dream meditation. Maybe a staff and bag just for a bowl and some possessions. And striding along, well, I want you to picture him on a plane, one of those wonderful Tibetan planes, a rocky plane. Mountains in the distance, an absolutely piercing blue sky, sunny, cold, and he's just there in that plane. He's just standing there, very purposeful, and he's waiting. He's waiting to meet his disciple Rechumpa. Rechumpa, well, we'll hear a bit more about Rechumpa. Rechumpa met Milarepa when he was a very young man, Rechumpa. And he learned the teachings very directly from Milarepa and made a lot of progress very, very quickly. He's one of the earliest of Milarepa's disciples. Milarepa refers to him frequently as his son. He's one of his heart sons. He's that close to Milarepa. But Rachumpa contracted leprosy quite early on in his discipleship of Milarepa, and the only cure for leprosy was in India. In those days, in India and Tibet, leprosy was regarded as a curse of a particular kind of demon. So Richard had to go off and get cured of this in India. And that kind of started in Richard a kind of feeling to go to India regularly. And he's coming back from nothing less than his third journey to India. He'd badgered Milarepa that he needed to go to India after one of his visits, perhaps his first visits, because he'd heard that in India there were all these special yogic teachings that were being given by a master named Dipupa, and he needed to go and get these teachings. And Milarepa said, "You don't need to do that. You really don't need to do that. What you need to do is stay here and get on with the teaching, get on with the practices that I've given you." You know, it's one of those things that sort of happens, you know, familiarity kind of breeds, well, if not contempt, you know, familiarity breeds a kind of, not even indifference, it kind of, well, you know, I know this bloke, I know this Milarepa guy, you know, he's given me the teachings, but there's something else, exotic India. You know, where the latest tantric stuff, you know, is coming into vogue. I've got to go there. And Milarepa says, "You really don't need to go. You really don't need to go." But Rechenpo is very willful, very determined. So on his third journey to India, he goes to India. And Milarepa says, "All right, go. But if you go, I want you to find a teaching called the Formless Dakini Teachings." The Formless Dakini teaching. Dakini is a kind of, how can you describe a Dakini? She's a female form, but a form kind of encapsulating, embodying the inspiration of Buddhahood, the surging, incredibly vital energy of enlightenment. But this, hey, is the Formless Dakini teachings. It's even more extraordinary because it doesn't even have a form. Wow. You know, what's the Formless Dakini teaching? So anyway, Rechenpa thinks, great, I'll go and get these teachings for my teacher. Of course, he's on his own trip as well. And he's coming back. Somehow Milarepa knows he's going to arrive at this particular spot on this particular plane, and Milarepa is going to be there to meet him. And Rechenpa is really full of himself. He's got all these different teachings, all these, the invocation to all these particular deities, really wacky, way out tantric figures. He's got the Formless Dakini teachings, which he can give to his own teacher, thus becoming his teacher's teacher. He's also been given the staff of this special medicinal arkara wood of Dipupa, you know, this, he's been honoured with this staff, you know, and he is thinking to himself, you know, here I am, you know, I'm coming back to show my teacher, you know, what a guy I am, you know, he's really got it, he's really swelling with pride, as we sometimes do in one way or another. And Milarepa knows it. You know, Milarepa often calls himself an old dog. Old dog Milarepa. Old dog Milarepa. You know, and he knows that in a way Rechenpa kind of sees him as an old dog. He doesn't see this. You know, we tend to think, well, if I was around somebody like Milarepa, I wouldn't do this. Oh, yeah, well, I'm afraid it's not quite like that, actually. We tend to do that if we read stories about the Buddha and you see the sort of stupid disciple and we think, oh, stupid disciple, I wouldn't do that, you know. I'd know that they were enlightened, but, you know, come on. It's much more important to identify with the stupid, recalcitrant disciple than with the enlightened one. Anyway, old dog Milarepa knows that Rechenpa is swollen with pride and conceit. And Richumpa comes, and he, you know, wants to present this teaching. I've brought the teachings for you. And Milarepa, it's quite clear that he really isn't interested. He just knows that he's just full of pride, and he's just not interested. You know, it's you know, he's not impressed. And Richumpa is seriously irritated. You know, he doesn't particularly want the. He said, "I don't really want these things. You know, I don't need them. I don't need these teachings. I don't need this stuff. I don't need what you've brought back from India." And Richumpa said, "Look, you know, I've brought all this stuff. You know, I've got all these teachings. You know, why don't you accept them?" And he said, I don't need them. Neither do you. They'll harm you." And Richumpa's getting really reactive, you know, really upset. So suddenly Milarepa just starts running. He just starts running, sprinting. He's in his 70s. Richumpa's probably half his age. And Milarepa's just, he's off. And Richumpa's, you know, desperately trying to keep up. He said, "Look, I've got the teachings. I'll give them to you. I've got the teachings." And Milarepa's just running. And in the end, Richumpa kind of breaks down and begs him to stop. And, you know, so Milarepa turns and he says, "Okay, look." And it's all done with songs, I should just say. It's all songs. It's almost like a musical. It's all the songs that go on and on forever. Because one of the things you have to understand about the Milarepa tradition is a kind of bardic tradition. The bard, you know, people would memorise the songs and pass them on, and they kind of develop and get added to. So then Milarepa sings this song, and he sings this song about all the teachings that Richumpa's got and so on and so forth. But he says, "The most important thing is your relationship with me. All these other things are really wonderful, but the most important thing is your relationship with me." Now Milarepa's not being egotistical here. He's not on any kind of guru trip or something like that. It's more that he's saying your connection with me is your connection with the Dharma, is your connection with the path. All this other stuff is a massive distraction. It's a massive distraction. This is the way you're serving your pride. Another thing, Richumpa was, you know, quite a scholar. Milarepa wasn't. Milarepa was a very, very simple man who spent his time meditating on the teachings, you know, and they're really stripped down. He wasn't interested in logic and logic chopping and all that kind of thing. And there's another story that happened a bit earlier on where Milarepa and Richumpa go to some logicians, and the logicians, Buddhist monks, challenge Milarepa to a debate. And Milarepa loses the debate. He doesn't know all the rules of Indo-Tibetan logic. So he kind of loses, and Richumpa's really disappointed. He thinks, you know, this, you know, you're an embarrassment, you know, you're letting yourself down. Milarepa said, "I'm not interested. This is completely beside the point." But poor old Richumpa's just really fixated on all this stuff. But Milarepa's saying, "Your connection with me is your connection with the Dharma." It made that pure, you know, connection there. And it is kind of like that, I think, sometimes. You know, that sometimes in spiritual practice, we connect with something. We connect with a path. We connect perhaps with a teacher or with a community or the disciples of a teacher. And we're going along with it quite well. And we're making kind of progress. We're unfolding. But then we kind of start feeling a little bit restless. "Oh, well, maybe it's not working. Maybe I'm not enlightened yet. And, you know, I should be, you know, because I've really got something," and all the rest of it. So we might start kind of shopping around, checking this out, checking that out. Maybe we have a big experience somewhere and we think, well, all that lot, they were all a little bit, you know, it's all a bit tame. But then we kind of lose our way and we kind of come back and maybe want to tell everybody about how enlightened we are or something like that. And maybe they're not particularly interested because they've got their path and they're going deeper into it. Can be a bit like that. There comes a point where you have to stop doing that if you're serious in your Dharma life. You have to kind of put your pride down and your grabbing attitude to spiritual life, your craving for a particular kind of experience that makes you feel really good about yourself, and instead get down to the real steadiness of serious practice, concentrated practice on a particular path, a particular way. Sort of, in a sense, doesn't matter what it is, so long as it's actually bringing about a real transformation, a real shift in the direction of greater awareness and greater love and compassion and service and generosity. Doesn't matter what it is, so long as it's doing that, and as long as you're really giving yourself to that and a particular community where that's happening. So in a way, Rechenpa is a kind of, even though it's such a different world to our own, a totally different world, there is a kind of message, I feel, here for, you know, for a lot of people in the modern world. So anyway, they, you know, Rechenpa is kind of back in communication with Milarepa, and they wander on. They move on, and it's getting late. They need to get some food because they're hungry. They're beggars, you know. They don't have any possessions, so they have to beg their food. And they come across a camp of nomads and other people, just a group of tents, people kind of huddling together, people travelling. And Milarepa starts moving towards one of the bigger tents, and Rechenpa, you know, still a bit up himself, to be honest. He said, no, we should go to the poorest tent because, you know, we need to give the merit of the person giving the food to us. So Milarepa says, all right, we'll go there. And out comes, as soon as they get near this small brown tent, out comes this furious old woman. She's absolutely livid and resentful with burning eyes. And she starts shouting at them and says, what are you doing? You know, you yogis, you just, you know, why are you begging? I'm not giving you what I've got. I haven't got much. You just clear off, go away. I don't want to give anything to you. And it's really abusive. Rechenpa's very upset. Milarepa says, come on, we'll go. And they're really hungry and tired. And they just have to find a place to sleep just outside the camp, just on the ground. You know, these guys are real ascetics, real kind of hermits, you know, they just stay anywhere. And in the night, in the dark of the night, there's, you know, a terrible sound from this small tent. And in the morning, they get up to go and beg, and Milarepa says, go to that tent. And they find that the old woman has died in the night. She's just died. There was a kind of epidemic in the area, and she's dead. And you know, this is really stirring them all up, or stirring Rechenpa up. And Milarepa sings a song. Not only, by the way, had she died, all her jewellery had been stolen, all her food had been stolen by the nomads. There was nothing left. There was just this corpse. And Milarepa sings to Rechenpa, son, all things are like this. Last night, this old woman was full of stinginess and worry, but now she is dead. And he gets Rechenpa to carry the corpse to a nearby marsh. Rechenpa finds this really freaky, feels he's going to be infected by this corpse. But Milarepa says, come on, you're the young one, take it to this marsh. And Milarepa performs the funeral ritual as the body, the corpse, is laid into the marsh. And then he sings, oh, the blessing of the Guru is beyond our comprehension. When the transiency of life strikes deeply into the heart, our thoughts and deeds turn naturally to Dharma. If repeatedly and continuously we contemplate death, we easily conquer the demon of laziness. No one knows when death descends, just as this woman last night. Rechenpa, do not be harsh, and listen to your guru. Look, all manifestations in the outer world are ephemeral like last night's dream. We feel utterly lost in sadness, thinking of this passing dream. Rechenpa, have you woken up from this bewilderment? oh, the more I think of this, the more I aspire to the Buddha and the Dharma. Human life is precarious as a single slim hair of a horse's tail, hanging on the verge of breaking. It may be snuffed out at any time, like this old woman last night. Do not cling to this life, Rajumpa, but listen to my song. And it goes on and on and on. I can't read all of this song. It just goes on singing like this about the grief, the sorrow he feels at the suffering of the world, the suffering of people that don't know that life is impermanent, that life is transient, that life passes. They get so caught up, whether they're rich, whether they're poor, you know, whether they're successful, whether they're unsuccessful, high and low, whatever they are, whoever they are, they don't know that this life is transient. So they behave in a way full of pride, full of conceit, full of self-clinging, full of harshness, and then the life is gone, and that's it. That's the end of it. And he says, this is kind of depressing, this thought, when you wake up to it. It's terribly, terribly sad. And there's so many themes in this response to this incident of the old lady dying after abusing them. So many themes. But the first theme I want to take up is the theme of pride and conceit. He uses this as a kind of teaching to Rechum. Rechum is so full of pride. And it's said that, you know, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, you know, the different realms of existence, the six realms of existence that are sort of seeing gods and anti-gods and animals and hungry ghosts and beings in states of a sort of purgatory, animals, and there's humans. And each of these different realms are kind of overwhelmed by a particular poison, a particular fault. And the poison, the fault of humans, is pride, is conceit. That's our particular besetting sin, as it were. That's our particular problem. It's a very interesting reflection, I think, that that's what we humans are kind of like. It's partly to do with this wonderful gift that we have in human consciousness, which is so precious. And it's this reflexive consciousness, this self consciousness. We're not completely identified with our sense experience. You know, it's, you know, wonderful to be identified with your sense experience, but the beautiful thing about human life is that we're not locked into that. We can put a gap between what happens when something affects our senses and behaviour. Thus, when, you know, somebody is abusive to us, we don't have to respond, you know, because of the hurt that they've caused. We can put a gap in that. We can reflect and we can act ethically in relation to them. We can act kindly in relation to them. Or, you know, if we're presented with, you know, a particular temptation of one kind or another, but which is going to harm another person, we might be presented with something that, you know, is you know, that we'd really like to have, but it could actually cause a lot of harm to another party, perhaps not present, or to, you know, or to the other person. We don't do that. We reflect. We think, no, I don't have to immediately respond to this. I can behave in a different way than what is presented to us. And, you know, we can even imagine, even beyond us, an ideal. You know, we can imagine the Buddha. We can imagine enlightenment. We can imagine becoming a being of wisdom and compassion that's beyond us. That all comes with this wonderful gift of reflexive consciousness. It really is, when in Buddhist tradition they talk about the precious human existence, that's what's really being talked about. It's not just the human body with all its faculties, it's this ability that we have to be, well, we can be ethical, we can follow a path, we don't just have to follow our senses. But it's a double-edged sword. There's another side to it. Because another thing that comes with self-consciousness is that we can start forming a fixed view about ourselves. That's really what pride and conceit is, mana, as it's called in in Sanskrit and Pali. We have a very fixed view about who we are and what we are. It fixes us in a particular relationship to other people, a particular relationship to life. And we sort of doom ourselves while we have conceit and pride to a very fixed state. We can't really, you know, change and develop while we're in that fixed state. And three kinds of conceit are recognised in Buddhist tradition. They're all, and the key word here is view. So the three kinds of conceit are the view that you're superior to others. The second is the view that you're inferior to others. And the third is the view that you're equal to others. Now let's just kind of unpack this a little bit. You know, it's quite explosive and powerful in a way, and I think incredibly helpful. Well, let's deal with the view that we're equal to others. There's that thing sometimes, it comes up a little bit in discussion groups when you do Buddhism, because Buddhism does recognise a sort of Dharma hierarchy, an ascending state, ascending states of consciousness, and some are higher than the other. And there might even be people who are in a higher state of consciousness than ourselves. There might well be people better than us. Wow! And there might be people less developed than us. And people get very uneasy and say, no, we're all equal. And I'm more equal than anybody. I'm the most equal person in existence. It's a view, it's an idea, it's an imposition. It's not willing to enter into, you know, if you like, the real dance of communication, where you have to be open, you know, to the changing states and the changing kind of movement of people. You know, there might well be in a particular kind of gathering, in a particular kind of meeting, somebody who really holds the truth more than you do. There might be times when you hold the truth more than another, and you have to kind of really take responsibility for that. So one needs to be open to that, but the view prevents you from really entering into experience. Then there's the view of being inferior. This view that you are the uniquely flawed individual. You know, sort of get this. You know, I used to pull this stunt. I don't do it so much now because my friends won't let me, but it's like that thing that Dharma is great, Buddha's teaching, fantastic. But I can't really do it, you know, I can't really, I'm not really very good, you know, and all this sort of thing. My friend said, well, you don't really, then you're saying that the Dharma doesn't work. You're saying it's no good, because the Buddha actually teaches that every single human being has the capacity to follow this particular teaching. No, I'm the uniquely flawed, you know, person. Of course, that's a massive assertion of ego. Monstrous egotism, you know, I'm that exception, you know, to the rule of, you know, to the laws of existence, you know, I'm the uniquely inferior, the really flawed one. I mean, that really won't do. That's lazy. It's terribly lazy. It's actually regarded as a laziness in the Buddhist tradition, that kind of faint-heartedness. You know, it's you know, there's no dignity to that position, and you just need to stop it if you go into that. It's interesting, it's in the stuff on laziness, this particular kind of laziness, the teachers often quote, well, the Buddha has said that even worms and ants and flies and maggots and other such creatures can gain enlightenment. Well, if they can, well, you can. And people think, how can a worm gain enlightenment? I think what the Buddha is saying, well, sometimes we sort of feel that we're rather worm-like or maggot-like. Well, that's okay, you can have that feeling, but you can become enlightened. Do you know what I mean? You can make progress. You can become an enlightened maggot. You see what I mean? So the view that you're inferior, that's got to go. But then, of course, there's the classic, the view that you're superior, that you really are better than others. And this is what Richenpur is really stuck in. You know, he's, and with that, there's a kind of narcissism conceit, pride, vanity. You know, he really fancies himself. As somebody once said of Glenn Hoddle, if he was an ice cream, he'd lick himself. I think it was Tony Cascarino who said that. I'm not sure. He was an ice cream he could lick himself. So Richard, who was like that. I'm sure that's not true of Grimhoff. Fantastic player. But anyway, Red Chimper has got that. He's really swollen with that kind of pride. And what and the teaching that Milarepa gives, you know, just in this situation, you know, which has happened spontaneously, suddenly an old woman who's abused them, abused Milarepa, has died suddenly. The teaching is on impermanence. This is the great cure for all kinds of pride. When the transiency of life strikes deeply into the heart, this is the cure. This is the way we wake up out of this dream, out of this view, out of this fixed view of our life. And you enter into this much more flexible, much more open way of entering into life. You know, not defining yourself, not limiting yourself to a particular kind of view or path or career or tram tracks, you know, going down into, you know, into the distance. You don't do any of that. You start opening up. You can see it immediately in Milarepa's response, you know, to the poor old lady. There, you notice in Milarepa there's no sense of retaliation. There's no sense of, you know, this stupid old woman. He calls her mean and stingy, but actually the response is utter compassion. He does her funeral rites for her. He doesn't have any doubt about doing that. There's no question of any kind of, you know, retribution or anything like that. There's, I mean, the text even says that Milarepa, through his meditative power, is able to release the consciousness of this woman into a higher state of consciousness. There's just nothing but compassion. When you really see impermanence, actually what you enter is into a state of forgiveness. Into a state of forgiveness. You know, one of the things that we do, one of the ways in which conceit works, is holding on to our hurts. Holding on to our hurts, constellating round our hurts. Perhaps that old woman, she was bitter because of so many hurts in her life. And we do this, we constellate around our hurts, perhaps in childhood or in our life generally. And we have this view of what's been done to us and what's happened in our life. But actually when you wake up to the impermanence of all life, the impermanence that could happen to you, you forgive. You let go. Forgiveness, I've been thinking quite a lot about forgiveness recently, and I've been thinking that forgiveness is, it's not just the forgiveness of the individual person. To really forgive the individual person, you have to forgive life. You have to forgive life. Life is change. Life is impermanent. Life means that you actually don't get what you want. Life means that people leave you. Life means sometimes that people are mean to you. It doesn't mean that you don't put things right that can be put right. But the attitude to it is this understanding, this deep acceptance and patience that this is what happens. It's not personal. It's not personal. You might be on the end of this, but so is he, so is she, so are they. This is the nature of existence. It's a wonderful saying in the Dhammapada, very early on in the Dhammapada. And I know that the Buddha is enlightened because of this saying. He says something like, it's a bit hard to translate, others do not realize that we are all heading for death. Those who do realize it will end their quarrels. Those who realize that actually everybody is heading for death and that death could come at any moment will end all quarrels with life, all quarrels with people in their life. And more positively, they shift, they move to compassion, to understanding, to forgiveness, to love. That's the shift that takes place. And this is the cure for pride. This is the way pride and conceit dissolve away. So this is Milarepa's teaching to Rechenpa. And he does break through a bit with this teaching to Rechenpa. He does start to soften. He stops being so hard and so harsh. So they move on. They walk on. They're going to go to a place where there's quite a gathering of the rest of Milarepa's disciples, the other yogis, the other cotton clad. But there are also lots of supporters where they're going nearby who they know will give them lots of food. And Rachumpa's really keen, really pleased to be coming back to the Sangha, to being with his brothers and sisters in the Dharma and to, you know, all these old friends. And of course, at the back of his mind, I've got the formalist darkening teachings. I've got the staff of Dipupa. That's still kind of there, lurking around. You know, Milarepa's broken through a bit, but there's a way to go. And as they move into this area, Rechungpa says, come on, let's go and get some food from our supporters. And Milarepa says, no, let's do something else. Let's just push on. Let's go into retreat. Let's go and do something. And, you know, Rechungpa says, no, he has to agree, but he's very, very sort of resentful about it, about the idea of doing that. Along the way, they pass a yak horn, you know, big, you know, from a dead yak, sort of circular horn, and Milarepa says, can you just pick that up and carry that for me? And Rechumpa's, he's getting really resentful. He's thinking, he's just old. He's old. Not only is he old, he's led this life of hardship, and he wants me to pick up this filthy old yak horn. He said, well, what do you want it for? He said, well, look, it's just been discarded. It won't harm. Just pick it up. Might come in handy. He's so miserly. He's so full of hatred for the world. He wants this old yak's horn. And, you know, in any case, I've got these wonderful teachings from India. And, of course, he'd seen some of these Indian teachers who live like kind of royalty. And he thought, well, I want to live like that. You know, what's all this hardship? I want to be one of these teachers. But anyway, they're wandering along, you know, in the middle of nowhere, on the way to see the patrons. And this big cloud comes up, and it starts pouring with rain, starts this torrential rain, and there's nowhere to shelter. Nowhere to shelter. And Rechungpa drops the yak horn trying to find shelter, and suddenly realises Milarepa's nowhere to be seen. And he, well, where is it? And then he suddenly hears this voice, and he realises it's coming from the yak horn. Somehow or other, through his yogic power, Milarepa's sheltering in the yak horn. So Rechungpa's bending down with the rain pouring down, and Milarepa's saying, come in, it's really dry. It's really dry inside. He said, I'm getting wet, you know, let me in. He said, well, go on, do your yogic stuff and get in, you know. And Rechungpa's, and he's looking, he said, well, there seems to be a lot of space in there. Milarepa's got plenty of room, you know, it's like a little cave. And Milarepa's singing all these tantric songs, really joyful and ecstatic. This old man, all nice and dry. Rechumpa's getting completely soaked. He's still not really getting the point, poor Rechumpa. So Milarepa makes the rain go away, and the sun comes out. He comes out of the yak horn, and they carry on their journey. But Rechumpa's still pretty resentful. And he wants to see the Sangha. And Milarepa says, no, we're going to do some more meditation. He says, look, I'll go up to the cave, Milarepa says. I'll go up to the cave and get a fire going. You give me all the stuff you brought back from India. And I'll go up to the cave. You go and get some water. So we can, you know, we can have a brew, presumably, or the Tibetan equivalent. So Rechumpa goes off to get some water at the stream. And he starts looking at the goats on the mountainside, and he likes mountain goats, and he finds these mountain goats far more interesting than the goats from his own area. And he's watching the goats, and he notices that the goats start copulating, and then very quickly more goats are born, until eventually there's about 200 goats out of about two. There's 200 goats, you know, all sort of playing, and he's watching it, and he's, wow, you know, these goats are really interesting. It's just more and more of them. God, look at that. All these goats going on. And suddenly, one of the goats turns into a wolf and gathers them all together. And at which point he kind of comes to, very interesting teaching here, which we might have time to go into I hope so, if I can remember it. So he suddenly comes to, and then he notices that there's smoke coming from the cave. Not only is there smoke, there's the smell of burning paper. He can't be. He's burning the formless darkening teachings. He's burning the precious tantric. He's evil. He's a bad person. You know, burning Dharma books. So he rushes up to the cave and he comes in and there's Milarepa just putting onto the fire these books like this. And what are you doing? It's bad. It's evil. Burning Dharma books. It's an evil thing. You're wrong. And he's absolutely murderous. He really wants to. And Milarepa said, look, you really don't need this teaching. You really, it's not helpful to you. So I'm much more useful as fuel to keep us warm. You're burning books. It's really wrong to burn books. You're a really bad teacher. You know, and he's going on like this, really resentful. So Milarepa starts looking at him. And he says, look at me. Look at me, Richard. I'm not looking at you. You're burning wrong. Look at me. So eventually he starts looking at him. And something starts to happen to Milarepa. Suddenly, there's a Buddha in his head chakra. There's a Buddha in his throat chakra. There's a Buddha in his heart chakra. There's a Buddha in his navel chakra. There's a Buddha in his secret place chakra. There are little birds flying around singing the Dharma. There are sort of skeins of silken rainbows going around. There are syllables going round and round, making the sound of the Dharma. And Milarepa just starts to say, look, you know, the books are all very good, but what about this? What about this wonder, this miracle? Well, I don't think much of that, Rinchenpo says. I want my books back. Look, Rinchenpo, look. Take a look at this. And it goes on. There's this fabulous vision taking place before him. And Rinchenpo is just not impressed. He wants his book back. So Milarepa goes outside and Rinchenpo follows. I want my books, I want my books. And Rinchenpo and Milarepa starts to kind of cut up the rocks outside with his hands. You know, and they just start. I said, Rinchenpo, look at this. Isn't that more interesting than your books? I want my books. The real miracle would be bringing my books. I want my books. He's going on like this, really like a spoiled child. While this wondrous thing is going on, Milarepa diving into rocks, going through them, coming out the other side, going on and on like this. And eventually, Milarepa just flies up into the sky and disappears. Just vanishes, singing songs. Now, at this point, Rinchenpo is really upset. He says, he's gone. My teacher's gone. He's vanished. I haven't got him anymore. What have I done? I've paid a really high price through going to India and getting these formless darkening teachings. And he's gone. And he really does feel absolutely terrible. So I want to just kind of pause on this a little bit. I better bring this bit of the story to an end first. So Rinchenpo just decides, well, it's not worth living without my teacher. My teacher who had the Dharma, it really isn't worth living. So he just throws himself off a cliff and falls very, very badly, really hurts himself. At which point, Milarepa appears, of course, and gives this wonderful teaching to him. And one of the things he starts going on about in this teaching, he says, it's really fascinating, isn't it, when you watch goats at play, but wouldn't you rather practice the Dharma? Wouldn't you rather really get involved in this? And he's manifesting all sorts of different forms of himself. So he's singing about all these wonderful things. And he keeps going on about, it's really interesting to watch the goats and to watch one of them become a wolf. But isn't it more interesting? Isn't it more vital to really look at these miracles? So I want to just try and dwell on this aspect of the story a little bit, see if it has any relevance to us. I think that one of the things that's going on with that story of Rinchenpo being completely obsessed with the goats copulating and growing and growing and growing and growing is, it's what we do, isn't it? We get fascinated with our proliferating minds. We get completely caught up in our dramas, in all the mental proliferations. You know, we have one particular drama going on in our mind, which may or may not be related to anything going on in the world around us, or it might be all to do with our hopes and fears and speculations and all the rest of it, or it might be to do with what's out there, but it's not really thought that's really tuned into that. It's much more sort of speculative or horrified or, you know, fantasizing about it. We get caught up in this proliferation of thought. We get obsessed with our own particular dramas, whether they're uplifting dramas or whether they're depressing dramas. And when we're in that kind of state, we ignore the divine appearance. We're actually closing our eyes to the divine appearance. Poor old Rinchenpo is so caught up in his pride, in his particular trip, in his particular kind of, his idea that he's really attained something, that really he really is someone, and all the kind of dramas that go with it. He can't see the wonder of this old man. He can't see the wonder, the Buddhahood, the Dharma, the truth of this old man. Milarepa is not just a man, he's a kind of cosmos. That's what he's showing. He's the kind of mediator of reality itself, in all its wonder and beauty and glory on all its levels. He's ecstatic with that, even though he looks like, yes, an old dog, an old green dog, you know, living in the mountains, living as a pauper in the mountains. But he's divine, you know, through his attainment. And poor, poor Rinchenpo can't see it. He just can't get it. He's so caught up in himself. And I guess we're like that, aren't we? We're like that. We kind of close ourselves so much to, you know, the wonder of existence and what we have. I mean, there is a sense, you know, this, we come to the LBC, you know, we come to this class, you know, and we come, perhaps we come every week, perhaps we come more than once a week. And, you know, we see this room with the Buddha in it and the order members and so on, and we ourselves, and there's a kind of sameness to it. But on another level, I don't know if you're aware of this, but this is a fantastic kind of palace, cosmic palace of the Buddhas and the Dakinis and, you know, all these wondrous creatures. And the order members here are actually, you know, great gurus and teachers. You know, they keep it quiet, but that's actually what they really are. And all of everybody coming to the classes are really, you know, the greatest possible disciples that you could possibly be. You know, all sort of Dakinis and Dakars, divine. That's our real state. You know, we're going around, you know, with what William Blake calls single vision. This very, very narrow view of things. What we need to start entering into is this far more open, mythic vision of things, which is much more like our real nature. But we're closed off to it because of our mental proliferations, because of our particular monotonous, fascinating dramas and trips. And one of the things that's happening in meditation is just blowing that away, blowing through that, through mindfulness, through metta. We're blowing through that. We can blow through it through communication, because that's another thing that's going on in this, you know, particular story. Milarepa is breaking through Rinchenpo's resistance. He's trying to open him up to that wondrous vision. But even the wondrous appearance, Rechen doesn't get. And it's only when Milarepa vanishes that he realises what he had. And he realises what he's lost. It's only when the guru really disappears, when you really feel that they've gone, it's only then you realise what you've got. Imagine if you turned up one day for this class and the LBC wasn't here. I mean, just imagine. I mean, I know it sounds a silly thing, but suddenly you came along and you think, it's not here, it's some other place. It's some sort of dream that you had. I mean, that would be pretty freaky, really, wouldn't it? And you'd think, what happened? Do you remember that lovely book, was it Le Grand Monde, you know, where that, you know, young, that young character, that wonderful house with the ball, and he's not sure whether he's dreamed it or not, or whether it really happened. Well, sometimes we have to really reflect, what would it be like if we didn't have the Dharma, if we didn't have spiritual friends, if we didn't have the teaching? Okay, we can see all sorts of faults in it, and there are. There are all sorts of faults. If you, Milarepa in another song to one of his disciples, I think it is to Rechinpa, he says, if you look for faults in your teacher, you'll find a mountain of them. You'll find a mountain of them. Once you start, you won't be able to stop. We've got to reverse that. We've actually got to look for what's really there and how it's really benefiting us and enriching us, so that we can push on, to a much deeper realization of the Dharma of existence. And then it's after that, after things are kind of settled down and Rechinpa is softened. Really softened up, then he's welcomed back into the community. Then he can be welcomed back into the Sangha and with the supporters. And there's a lovely moment where Milarepa and Rechinpa sing songs to each other about what has gone on for the benefit of the rest of the Sangha. So I'm going to start winding up. I'm going to move now more right near to the end of Milarepa's life. And it's a story called Rechinpa's Journey to Wu, and it's probably, that's central Tibet. And it's probably one of the last meetings between Rechinpa and Milarepa. There's a very interesting, lots of sort of scholars have kind of looked critically at, Rechinpa and Milarepa. Milarepa's main, well, his son-like, S-U-N, disciple was Gampopa, who becomes the sort of fountainhead of the lineages that follow on from Milarepa. Rechinpa is called the moon-like disciple, because he obviously gave Milarepa a lot of trouble. But some people believe that, there's been a certain amount of playing around with the sort of lineage histories, and actually Rechinpa was really the close disciple of Milarepa. And that's interesting in itself, because it's quite clear Rechinpa was in some ways his most difficult disciple. But Milarepa absolutely loved Rechinpa. There's a song towards the end in Rechinpa's Journey to Wu where Milarepa sings about telling some supporters about Rechinpa. He says, with body handsomer than a god's, he left. With a voice mellower than an angel's, he left. With words sweeter than all music, he left. With mind brighter than embroidery, he left. Smelling more fragrant than sweet incense, he left. So this is Milarepa singing about Rechinpa. He loved Rechinpa, loved him. This is real sort of spiritual, dharmic eros. He sees the beauty of his disciple. This is very unusual in a teacher to sing so lovingly of a disciple in this way. How beautiful Rechinpa was to him, even though Rechinpa gave him a lot of trouble. And at the end, it's still kind of going on. In this particular story at the end, Rechinpa is staying with Milarepa in these caves, in a little community. And he realizes that that the disciples or the supporters are giving better offerings to him and bad offerings to Milarepa. Milarepa is getting really old. He even says, when the yogin gets old, his realization grows dimmer because he's not so strong. Rechinpa is obviously a much more kind of charismatic figure, and so the supporters are kind of thinking, oh, Rechinpa's the man now. And Milarepa's just the old dog. And there's this touching moment where Rechinpa comes into Milarepa's cave and he sees Milarepa sleeping like a bird. Beautiful expression, sleeping like a bird, just curled up on the ground. This old, thin man curled up on the ground. And he feels immense tenderness for him. And he feels, actually, I need to go away, so that Milarepa can have, can have better offerings. It's a really touching moment. So he says, when Milarepa rises, explains what he thinks is happening. And he says, I want to go. I think I should go. I think I should go to central Tibet on pilgrimage. And Milarepa says, no, I don't think you should go. Stay here. Deepen your meditation. Stay with me. Stay with the community. But Rechungpa really wants to go. Milarepa thinks, okay, it's time to go. And he asked him, there's a wonderful kind of dialogue where he says, how will you go? How will you travel there? And he answers in all this Dharmic language how he will walk, how he will be faithful to the lineage, how he'll be faithful to the teaching. And it goes on like this. So Milarepa says, okay, go. He gives his blessings. But he feels sad. He feels sad about this. And this is, again, very, very poignant. You know, we tend to think that the big teacher, the big guru, should be all cool and equanimous and non-attachment. And of course, Milarepa isn't attached. He's not, you know, neurotic about Rechungpa going. But he knows that Rechungpa going, with body handsomer than a god's and with a voice sweeter than an angel's and so on, he knows that the community will be diminished, that something will be going, will be leaving with Rechungpa. Doesn't make any difference to Milarepa's enlightenment, his insight. But he knows that's the case. We even get this with the Buddha, the great, wonderful Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, the supreme master of the tradition. When his two chief disciples, Shariputra and Mahamudgalyana, passed away, entered Parinirvana, the Buddha said, the assembly, the Sangha is diminished. The Sangha is empty without these men. So we mustn't think that enlightenment is a sort of blank state where you don't even notice change. You don't notice when certain lights go out of the assembly. Of course you do. Of course you do. It doesn't make any difference to your love, to your compassion, to your bliss, to your ecstasy, to your peace. But you notice it. You notice it. Of course you notice it. So this is really important. I kind of hate that kind of pseudo-Buddhism where people kind of pretend that they don't have any feelings, you know, because they don't have a self. It's just so ridiculous, so stupid. Such a lack of Dharmic culture, real Dharma culture, that kind of, you know, vibration. It's really awful. And it's just the excuse for impoverishment, emotional impoverishment, when you hear about Milarepa feeling sad that his disciple is going. You know, you know the great Milarepa, the great yogi, yes, this is what the Dharma is really about. When you hear that the Buddha notices that his great disciples are no longer there, yes, that's what it's like. So Rechungpa goes, Milarepa really watches him into the distance, gives him final teachings. And then, of course, the supporters come, as supporters do. And they, this time, they say, Rechungpa wasn't a very good disciple, was he? And Milarepa said, no, he was a wonderful disciple. He is a wonderful disciple. And this is where he sings this song about how handsome Rechungpa is and how away he's going to practice. He rejoices joyfully. And then he gives a real teaching on, what they're like. The supporters, he says, he sings this. When a rock grows old, grime encrusts its face. When streams grow old, wrinkles cover its bed. When a tree grows old, its leaves soon fall off. When a hermitage grows old, water and plantains disappear. When a yogi ages, his experience and his realization grow dimmer. When supporters grow old, their faith soon wears out. And he goes on in this way, and they all feel very, very remorseful at, you know, what Milarepa has suddenly realized, that they're just trying to play him against Rechungpa, as they've been playing Rechungpa against him. But Milarepa, he's an old dog. He knows all their tricks. And he sings a final song. Milarepa isn't going to be pinned down by anyone. He's going to go off wandering again, even though he's an old man. He's going to carry on the journey. He really is a proper Dharmachari. You know, our sort of members, our ordination is called Dharmachari or Dharmacharini ordination, somebody who fares on in the Dharma. Okay, we don't wanderer like Milarepa, but really that's what we should be doing spiritually, that we're never staying in any particular place of consciousness. We don't define ourselves with that conceited, fixed self-view. That's what we should be like. That's what we're aspiring to do. We need to be faring on always in the Dharma life. Milarepa fares on. He sings a song, a very famous song. So I'm going to just read it to you, and then that will be the end of the talk. In the immense blue sky above, roll on the sun and moon. Their courses mark the change of time. Blue sky, I wish you health and fortune. For I, the moon and sun, am leaving to visit the four continents for pleasure. On the mountain peak is a great rock, round which oft the vulture circles, the king of birds. Their meeting and their parting mark the change of time. Dear rock, be well and healthy, for I, the vulture, now will fly away into the vast space for pleasure. May lightnings never strike you, may I not be caught by snares. Inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon. Below in the Tsang River swim fish with golden eyes. Their meeting and their parting mark the change of time. Dear stream, be well and healthy, for I, the fish, am leaving for the Ganges for diversion. May irrigators never drain you, may fishermen ne'er net me. Inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon. In the fair garden blooms the flower, circling round it is the Persian bee. Their meeting and their parting mark the change of time. Dear flower, be well and healthy, for I will see the Ganges blooms for pleasure. May hail not beat down upon you, may winds blow me not away. Inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon. Circling round the yogi Milarepa are the faithful supporters from Yanon. Their meeting and their parting mark the change of time. Be well and healthy, dear supporters, as I leave for the far mountains for diversion. May I, the yogi, make good progress, and you, my supporters, all live long. Inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon.